Hello and welcome back to Mommy Jojo Uncut Mojo Injection, episode 22. And it's National Novel Writing Week, so I have an award-winning author, Angela Jackson, a dear friend of mine. I think she's wonderful, and she was recently named one of the City of Literature's Emerging Writers of the Year. She's won tons of awards. By day, she's a coach and lecturer in psychology and education. She's written some amazing features that I've read. She's such a fascinating person, and you will know that if you tune in shortly. I'm so pleased to have had Angela around for a chat. Think the world of this woman, and she's going to inspire you so much. So enjoy, guys. I've had a really interesting week. It's been tough. For those of you that follow my social, it's been a really tough few days. The messages I've had from people and the support is what has made me bounce back. I've been blown away by the number of messages I've had. Because it's difficult when you're known as the queen of positivity and you put a post out that really isn't, and you make yourself very vulnerable, and it can be taken the wrong way. I get that, okay? Ego, it impacts us all and it does pull us from our mojo, but we do have ego. We can get defensive. I can get defensive. Things can be taken out of context. Ego impacts us all. I'm not about ego. I never have been. I'm not about logic over fairness. I'm not about politics. I'm about kindness, empathy, making as much noise as possible so that things that are wrong are changed. I am very much the person that follows their heart. I listen to my readers, and I've been doing a lot of research because you know I'm incredibly inquisitive. And this weekend alone, I spoke with several leaders who I respect in the field of kids' education, and I'm currently working on a proposal to ensure that first-come, first-served basis events for young children are banned across schools. This policy is going to be put in place because the impact of a child's mental health and also a parent's mental health is... You know, this is an issue. People are writing to me to tell me their kids are being excluded and people are letting it happen. Not just councils. Councils work hard. They're amazing people. I will be joining my council. That's one of the best things that's come out of this. But communities should not let that happen. Kids should not be excluded. Kids should not be ignored. Parents should not be ignored when they make suggestions. And I've learned a lot. And I'm just so thankful for the support I've had. And I think those of you that have read my book and tune into this weekly will genuinely understand the work I do and why I have the passion I have. So I just want to say a massive thank you. You will never know how much it means to me. Now, let's get Angela on. Thanks, guys. So welcome, darling.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
Always nice to see you. And you're just totally talented and an inspiration for me because you're an award-winning author for one, which is amazing.
Thank you.
Book's amazing. I've read it. It's so cool when you read a book and you've met the author and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I get that when I read a book and then I'll meet them at the book festival or something and I get a real thrill from that. I love it.
I mean, I just, I'm so inspired by the way you write. Where did this all come from? Did you always have that vision to be a writer?
I don't know if I had the vision to be a writer, but I've always written, and it was the first thing I was ever paid for. So in school, I wrote a story, and back in the days when you could be sent to the headmistress's office and she would give you money, that's what happened. I wrote a story and my form tutor sent me to the headmistress, and I can't remember what she gave me, 50p or something. And I thought, this is interesting, get paid for this. And then I just didn't write at all for the first part of my career, all through my 20s. I had a child, got married, yada yada, just normal life. But then one day I found a lump in my breast, went for a mammogram, and it was all fine, everything turned out okay. But I was sitting in the waiting room And it was a fabulous NHS facility. It's where you got the same day results. You stayed on the premises. Really nice place. A lot of us around. And, you know, every time you made eye contact with somebody, you knew that you were both waiting for the same answer. Oh, you, yeah. But, you know, and so they'd do something. They'd, you know, take a needle biopsy. Then you'd go and walk around the grounds, and then you'd go back. And then at the end of it, you have to go into the surgery to meet the doctor. And I bet everybody does that walk holding the breath. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think that, you know, life is full of those moments, those dramatic moments mm-hmm. where, you know, you're waiting for an answer, or, you know, something could change your life. And I thought that every person in that room, their life would be changed in some way, whatever answer you got, mm-hmm. you know. So you're sitting there sort of bargaining and saying, you know, well, if everything's all right, you know, I'm never going to eat another bar of fruit and nut again, you know, that kind of. Yeah. But so that's where it started. I had the whole day off for that because it was a whole day thing. And I got home mid-afternoon. And something in me just wanted to write it down. And I started to write it actually as a screenplay. And I had no idea what a script looked like. And I struggled with it for a couple of weeks, maybe 3 or 4 weeks actually. And then I thought, I don't know what I'm supposed to put in a script. Do I put what the actors do? Or? And I was sitting there looking at a wall full of books thinking, well, I know how to write a book. You know, I've read a lot of books. I've never seen a script. And so I started again from scratch and started to write it as a book. And of course, then I realised I didn't really know how to write a book, but I knew how to form a story. And I think that's in most of us. I think most of us, we've grown up with stories. Do you know what I mean? We are told stories as children. I think when something happens to us, we make a story of it, we make sense of it so that we can tell it to somebody else. So, you know, when you get home from work and something's happened, and, you know, you form the story so it's got a beginning, a middle and an end. And so luckily, I had a friend who read it, and she was actually a lecturer in English literature, and she passed it to a friend who put it on the desk of an agent who loved it, and so I was signed up really quickly. And I know that's not really what happens. I mean, that was a bit of a fairy tale. However, I know how difficult it is to get published, because I did have the tricky second novel syndrome. Mm-hmm. And my confidence strangely just plummeted after I was published. I started feeling a bit like a fraud. You know, I've not trained for this. You know, my training's in psychology, and I, you know, I don't know if I can write a second book, and maybe I'm a fluke, and all of that stuff that you tell you. Yeah,
limiting beliefs. Absolutely. The buzzword for them now.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I started writing in a different way, in not as natural a way, and not my own voice. And I did a master's in creative writing, which further buried my voice.
Really? Yeah. So the master's in creative writing actually took away your creativity?
I think what I was trying to do, I was on a course where literary fiction was very highly valued, and commercial fiction, which is what I write, mm-hmm. And what I love writing, and I think what I do most naturally, that's my voice,
yeah.
Where commercial fiction wasn't really valued. And so,
what's the difference between the two for people that may not know?
Sure. So commercial fiction is very accessible. Mm-hmm. It's about things we all know about, you know, day to day, real life things that happen to us. Mm-hmm. Often it has quite a funny edge to it. Or, so that's commercial fiction. The kind of books that you'd also, in addition to picking up in, you know, chains and bookshops, you would also see perhaps on supermarket shelves or in the airport. Or so, I mean, that's a very broad definition. Mm-hmm. Literary fiction, I'm going to say that you have to work harder to read literary fiction.
Yeah.
And it has more, let's say, more symbolism in it and probably more depth. And I think there was a value judgment placed on literary fiction on the course I was on. So I felt quite out of my depth. I felt like my voice wasn't, my voice wasn't valid. My voice was just not right, really. I didn't feel like an author, even though while I was on the course, I won Edinburgh International Book Festival's first book award.
That's insane.
Against 42 international authors, many of whom were writing literary fiction. And even that couldn't pull me out of, I don't think I'm a writer. So actually, that agent that I got so easily, I also lost her so easily because I lost my way.
You lost your confidence.
I lost my confidence.
Your authenticity.
Absolutely, I lost my authenticity. I really did. And my agent did try to discourage me from doing the master's. She said, you can write, you've done it. You've written a book that is out there on the shelves with barely any editing done to it. So you can clearly do it. But I didn't believe that I could do it. I felt as though I needed academic training in writing, and that's nonsense.
I hear that voice too. I mean, I went with a smaller publisher. I didn't really have that much help. The editors, it's great, it's fine, you know. And I was like, what do you want to change? Do you want to change more?
Yeah.
Whereas if it had been a bigger publishing house, they may have ripped my book to shreds, you know, apart. I mean, Sean was very much, we want your authentic voice. That's his kind of thing. So I thought, well, I'll go with it because of the style of my book. But I heard all those voices. Oh, would a bigger publisher have jazzed it up more? Should I do more courses? And the book was resonating with people.
Yes.
And I was going, I'm picking it to pieces.
That's the thing. And when you read books, don't you want to hear the author's voice?
Yeah.
That's what we love about reading. Yeah. We love reading the authentic voice.
Uh-huh.
And so I can see why your publisher, because your book is very authentic. I mean, you jump off the pages. And so I can see why your publisher has gone, no, let's not rip it to shreds. Yeah. Let's have you on the page. Because that's what people want. They do want an authentic voice. And I think, you know, when you say to people, well, what's your favourite author? It's somebody who resonates with you, somebody who's talking about the stuff that in some way touches you, or they're able to tell a story in a way that you understand. And so yeah, I think the authentic voice is amazing, but you do get that in literary fiction as well as commercial fiction. But yes, I think it's very easy for us to think, well, we're a fluke or we're a one-off, you know, if we have a bit of success. And that's a shame that we do that, really. And we need people around us to say, it's not a fluke. Yeah. And, you happen to be good at this, but you have been doing it for a long time, albeit not in a professional way.
I think it's a cultural thing, though, because if we lived in America, they've got so much confidence, whereas in the UK, it's that fear of shining too bright or getting too big for your boots, you know. And it's, if you have a talent, you need to be reminded of it and encouraged, and you know, it's tricky.
I think it is tricky, and I think also it's about fitting in. And I think we have these fixed ideas of what an author is and what they look like and what they sound like, you know. And you know, I'm from Wigan and working class, very much a working class upbringing. I live here in Edinburgh now and love it. But, you know, that is not a traditional route into a writing career. And so I've sat in, for example, the Author's Year at the International Book Festival here in Edinburgh, and I felt completely out of place. And that's not because anybody made me feel that way.
Yeah.
It's because I made me feel that way. I didn't have the same accent as these people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I didn't have the same background as these people. I didn't go to the same schools and universities as these people. So, and I think it's very easy to make yourself isolated and get into that place where you're very wobbly. And it's easy, it's easier not to do something, isn't it? And it's easier just to say, well, I can go back into teaching or, you know. But actually, I mean, I've written the second book now.
Amazing.
I'm editing it now. And I think my agent was probably right that my second book needed to come out a lot sooner than it did. I've probably almost certainly lost the readers that I had 5 years ago, and so I'm starting from scratch. I'm almost going to be a new writer again because I've lost that momentum.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's still there, and I mean, let's talk about the first book first, because you know the awards. It's so impressive, and I've read the whole thing. And what you were saying about the breast cancer, it takes me back to that part in the book, and going to the pub after with these having the gins. And I was just getting really sucked into the story and nearly rooting for. I mean, I was at one point rooting for the hubs as well, though. You know, you sort of flip between. Because part of me was thinking, were you ever tempted to write a non-fiction, but is it easier in a way to bring the characters in? Were all the characters based on someone?
Yeah, I think I like writing fiction, and I like inventing characters as well. I think that's a really interesting part of writing. Yeah, it's fun, it is. I was never tempted to write non-fiction. I suppose, you know, none of the characters are based on anybody in particular, but there are bits of, you know, I mean, I sort of brought my nan to life again a little bit in one of the characters, and so that's nice. You know, you can bring bits of people back to life or people you've lost touch with and inject bits of them into characters.
Oh, I love that. It's funny because the only part of my book, chapter 3, that's kind of fiction is based on Sophie, who's not a real person.
Okay.
And I had so much feedback about that chapter, but she was based on, I said at the end of the chapter, P.S., you know, Sophie's not a real person.
Right.
But she's based on so many people.
Okay.
You know, that perfect, you know, everything has to be perfect.
Okay.
I love the thought of bringing lots of characters. But for me, I would probably, like, may base some characters on people that I knew. But I would sort of feel like I had to ask their permission if I was, you know, going to base it too much.
I think that would just be, you'd have to do that. That would just be manners, wouldn't it, if you were going to basically recreate them in the book. Uh-huh. But I think, you know, there are qualities in people that just stand out. Yeah. And even people you don't know, you might be sitting next to somebody on the bus and you're chatting with them and your writer's brain is going, I'm having that.
I'm a writer. Anything you do see me be used in a story, be careful what you say. I mean, the amount of blog posts that I've put out just from being inspired by someone that was either an absolute asshole or said something really, I mean, words are so powerful.
Yeah.
Like, they're so powerful.
Well, you know, they say never piss off a writer because, you know, they might put you in a book and kill you. And I've actually done that. Well, a guy who fired me when I was a very young mum, you know, and I was a young single mum and I had to, you know, pay the mortgage and all the rest. And he knew my circumstances and he fired me for disagreeing with him in a meeting. Because I was a young upstart of a woman.
He was intimidated by a strong woman.
Yeah, so I kill him in a book.
Yes, karma's a bitch. Oh, I love it.
So he meets with a nasty end in the second book.
Oh.
No spoilers, but yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I can't wait to read the next one.
Thank you. Yeah, I've really enjoyed doing it. It's not a follow-on from the first book, completely new set of characters, completely different situation.
Because I want to know what happens.
Okay, well, it's about infidelity and it's also about how we live with certain things that happen to us in life. So my book, the second book, opens up with a scene from childhood, and the main character Mark is about to play the winning, I don't understand cricket terminology, but the winning point anyway, yeah, for the match. And he swings the bat, and he swings this cricket bat so hard that it hits his best friend on the temple and kills his best friend.
Wow.
And so I just think, how do you live with something like that? I mean, it's not something I've experienced, and I don't know anybody who has experienced it. Mm-hmm. But you read and hear all the time about people who've accidentally killed somebody, you know, in a road traffic accident or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, how would a character live with that, yeah, and what happens? And so I explore the turmoil of that and how a marriage can be sometimes based on fixing. He marries somebody who can fix him. Mm-hmm. And what happens when that person is fixed? You know, the dynamic of the marriage would have to change. And so I've read up a lot on infidelity. I was going to say I've researched a lot of infidelity, but I've read up a lot about infidelity. And what strikes me, I didn't know this before I started reading up on it, but what strikes me is we tend to think that infidelity is about sex, about just going for somebody, you know, a younger, slimmer model, is the stereotype. And actually, it's not really that. I mean, there's obviously some element of that, and individual cases would vary. But it's actually about seeing yourself through somebody else's eyes, somebody who doesn't think you're broken, mm-hmm, somebody who thinks you're great the way you are.
Yeah, they don't want to change you.
They don't want to change you. Yeah. And so I find that fascinating. And I find relationships fascinating anyway.
Me too.
You know, if anybody starts talking about the relationship, I'm all ears.
Oh yeah, me too. I think that's a writer's trait.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely love it. You know how relationships work, and you know what keeps them on the rails, and you know, I've been with my husband now for 24 years, and so we've got that long relationship that goes through everything. Do you know what I mean?
So,
and how do you keep it together? Do you know what I mean? And I think there's no secret. And I'm very interested in what people say about how they, what does Esther Perel call it? She calls it the anchor and the waves, the anchor of a safe relationship that keeps you in one place. And do you choose the anchor, or do you choose the choppy waves?
More passionate.
And that's right. And she talks about, you know, how to keep passion alive in a relationship, and how not to just look at your partner as an extension of yourself.
Yes.
You know, that they're a separate person and they've got separate stuff going on, even though we might think we know everything that's going on in our partner's heads.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really. I have no idea what's going on in my partner's head at the moment, because my husband's head at the moment, he's doing a course on existentialism, and at the moment I don't really understand about four sentences in five that he's saying.
Yeah. So it's hard as well, because when you're both passionate about different things at times as well, and you're trying to have things to talk about, and not just if you're consumed with your book or something and you just want to talk about that, and then they're at work and they've got things to bring to the table, and you take each other for granted, you're doing the dishes,
yeah,
and you've got your to-do list,
yeah,
and he's like, are you listening to what I'm saying? Or if he's telling me a story, he'll be like, are you just getting ideas for your book? You know,
he's like, this is not material.
He's like, you're really interested in this, you're totally researching me right
now. Stop making notes.
Stop it. I'm like, oh, but that's really good, just say that again. And it's so easy to take each other for granted, isn't
it? Really it really is. Oh. And that thing about not seeing each other, and I think it's really important to look at each other.
Yeah.
You know, we're so used to seeing each other. But I do think it's very, very important to keep connecting and keep... Well, I think it's important to take responsibility as well for keeping yourself as a separate entity.
Yeah.
You know, so I know that I was probably a very different person when I first met my husband,
yeah,
you know, and I've changed and developed, and so has he. And I think that's part of what has helped to keep us together, that we both like change, we both embrace change, we're up for new challenges and things, and so we've always got something to talk about, you know, okay. Even if it's existentialism, we've always got something that, you know, the latest passion, the latest thing, you know, okay. that we're working on. So okay. whether it's a creative project or just, you know, a course that we're doing or something. And I think that's really, it feels really important. I mean, you can't be prescriptive about other people's relationships, but that does feel important to me, that you're separate and different as well as together.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's hard, isn't it?
Oh, it's hard.
It's growing together, but...
And then kids come along.
Oh, that just adds another whole thing into
absolutely.
The mix. Absolutely, you know?
Yeah.
I guess it's talking, it's communicating, and being as open as you can be.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing. I mean, I had a divorce lawyer on here, and that was the first thing she
said.
I said to her, so what's the number one issue? And it's communication, of course. People just don't talk to each other.
No.
So if there's an issue and it builds... So, for example, if Scott's really annoyed about the lack of housework... And he just lets it build and build and build. And I'm like, no, don't let it build. Just tell me. We'll talk about it. We'll get a cleaner. I mean, I know you were saying a cleaner saved your life. Did you know?
It should probably save my marriage. Yeah, I mean, and again, it's that guilt, isn't it? I come from a really working class background. I knew more cleaners than people who had cleaners.
Uh-huh.
And over this past couple of months... I've had a cleaner who's come in for 2 hours a week, and it's made such a difference to us, and she's great, and I really value what she does, and we talk about what she does and how much I value it, and listen to me, I'm saying I value it as though it's my responsibility, and it's not, it's all of our responsibility, it's my son's and my husband's responsibility as well, but guess who ends up doing most of it. And so I'm doing a full-time university course, I'm teaching, I'm writing, and something had to give, you know, and I do suffer with anxiety, and part of that anxiety is I need everything to look right,
so
you know.
Control the environment.
I control the environment, so I don't like mess, and I don't like things when, you know, I don't like a dirty sink or you know, dishes everywhere. It just makes me feel anxious. And again, it's not a value judgment. It's just, it gives me anxiety.
It's so common though, because for me, I love a clean, tidy room. I love a space.
Yeah.
But at the same time, my work comes first. So if I've got an article due and there's dishes in the sink,
Can you leave the dishes and do it?
I have
really?
To, because for me, I'm so focused. But then I think it's because Scott's the opposite. He could not sit and do his work until the dishes are done. Even if he's got to.
I understand that.
It's a different, I think you're in one camp or the other. I still like, I've taken an interior design test and he said, I didn't pick the rock and roll because it was perhaps a bit too cluttered for me and I needed something more rustic and contemporary because my work is so chaotic and I give all my energy to it. I do love calm, clean spaces. But something I have to give. I mean, four school runs some days. Trying to make the dinner as well, and it was like I just can't do it all.
Yeah.
I can't. But
so do you get help?
Well, not yet. We're in negotiation, but Scott loves to clean.
Well, I love to clean.
Yeah. So
and
that
I,
helps.
I think, you know, that's the thing with procrastination as well. I think writers, most writers, will always find a nice surface to clean rather than face the blank page. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's always a cat to feed or, you know, something to do. You need to make the bed or... So I think that was part of the problem as well. I was not... It's not that I wasn't writing because I was busy cleaning, but it certainly didn't help. And it certainly gave me an excuse not to sit and face the blank page.
And what, so when are you in flow? Have you got a formula? What brings on your creativity?
Do you know, to be honest, I think it's an external deadline. So I'll tell you what, I've put a lot of deadlines on myself and self-imposed deadlines don't work for me.
Okay.
You know, so I'll say, that will be finished by the end of. And it's not, because it's not a real deadline.
Okay.
So I do, and I didn't know this about myself, I do respond to a proper deadline. But also, you know, having the space to write, and I don't just mean a physical space, I mean the head space to write. But we can't always create the perfect conditions. You know, sometimes, you know, we've got to sit surrounded by a bit of mess and, you know, a cat that doesn't like this week's cat food. Mm-hmm. And we've, you know, we've just got to buckle down to it. I think it's easy not to write because you can be very vague as well. When somebody says, how are things going? You can say, great. And that doesn't mean anything, really.
Yeah.
You know, nobody will ask you your word count unless it's another writer.
Yeah.
You know, nobody says, how many words did you do this week, Jojo? You can just say, oh, it's going great. Yeah, I'm just plodding on and on. Yeah. And so it's not like where you're in a normal job where everybody's working. It's a working environment. You know, you're not going to suddenly start cleaning your desk.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very hard for people who work from home to have the motivation to buckle down to it.
To get into
it. Yeah, I think it's hard whatever you're doing if you're doing it from home.
I think when you're in your flow, though, it feels so good.
Oh, I love being in flow. I love it. You forget the time, you forget everything else exists. I love that.
And
that's when you go, I love my job.
Yeah.
I love it. It's working, you know. But I tell you how I get into that, though. I do this thing where I sort of physically pretend I'm inhabiting the body of a character. So I get into their body language.
Right.
So, you know, I'll sit, for example, like a character in my second book's called Sadie. I will sit, I will sit like Sadie sits. And I'll talk like she talks. So Sadie talks like this.
I love it.
And it's quite soft and it's scouse, but you know, this is how she talks. And so her facial expression's different from mine, and so she speaks differently. So when I'm writing up Sadie, I'm writing in her accent, and I'm writing in her body almost. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And so. And I think that's for me, is how I can get their authentic voices. Because they say the true test is take away all the tags after your speech. So said Sadie, said Mark, said Ruby. And you should still be able to tell, just looking at the speech, who's speaking.
Right.
If you know, it's a good test. It's a good test.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So changing the tone. And
absolutely. Changing the tone and the language they use. And all of that. I mean, that, you know, I think it's quite challenging as well, differentiating between characters, because these are people that don't even exist apart from in your head.
So
that's, you know, that's a challenge as well. And I often cut out photographs and stick them up on a board of people who I think look like my characters.
Oh, I love this.
So, you know, I've got a Sadie, and I've got a Mark, and I've got Sadie's mom and dad, and you know, I've got all of those characters, and I don't know who they are. They're just faces I've found. So what I've done is I've done a description of how I see the character, and then looked at lots and lots of faces, and then printed them off, cut them out, and there they are.
Oh, I love that. See, I started doing some research for my second book and an idea I'm playing with, and I was interviewing someone who has given me permission to use them as a character.
Oh.
And I said, what would your character be called? And she told me, I said, okay, we could do that name. So it was kind of like letting them have a little bit of a pick if we go with that one, which I think could have arms and legs. But yeah, and then I'm not sure if it would work out where I would interview every person. Some may be in my head, but some may be based on people. So what would you like to be called? And what would, if it was based on me and part of it, what would I call?
Start
to like make all these notes. And
I think that's a really good way of doing it as well. It's like just, you know, scaffolding the characters and writing a little bit about your characters before you get started.
Yeah.
So you've almost got the full cast,
you
know what I mean? And they'll develop through the book, and they might change because of, you know, the plot or what happens to them in the course of the novel. But I think starting off with a really strong idea, certainly of who your main characters are, it's really helpful. And it helps me because, you know, as I say, I can almost physically be, I imagine that I'm, you know, that character. And that works for male characters as well as female
Amazing.
Characters as well.
Love that.
Yeah, so just don't wax the moustache for a couple of days.
Speaking of like this, at your best. So,
I mean, how many main characters should you have?
Oh, I, you know, I think that there are no rules. And I think if something is engaging and resonant, then, you know, it's quite right that there should be no main rules. I think it's important for a writer, though, to be able to keep them all different and separate mm-hmm. and keep a really strong grip on them. Mm-hmm. So I belonged to a writing group. In fact, I set the writing group up a few years ago, and we used to meet and talk about our characters, and they became real for everybody in the writing group. And one of the main things that one of the main bits of feedback that we would give each other is, would that character really do that? We got to know the characters really well. And so I think if you're playing with a huge cast of characters, that can be a risk, that, you know, you almost forget who they are as individuals. Mm-hmm. And I think the readers need to keep a grip on who they are as well.
Exactly, you don't want it to become too confusing.
That's right, yeah.
I'm thinking, I love Sex and the City, so yes. you've got four strong female characters
that's
that
it.
Are all different and, you know, you buy into them.
Yes. And you couldn't imagine, for example, you couldn't imagine Carrie saying a line that Charlotte would say.
Exactly.
They're so differentiated, and I think that's the key. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's probably a good idea to keep a small cast of main characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, certainly for my first book, it was one main character, and that was Judy. I mean, the clues in the title, the emergence of Judy Taylor, but actually there was a well-defined cast around her. But what we always wanted to know was what was happening to Judy. It's very interesting. I'm doing a film course at the moment, writing for screen and television. In Glasgow. I'm loving it. But one of the quotes that I've written down from the tutor is, I'll tell you what viewers, and I've translated this to readers as well, I'll tell you what viewers want to know. They're not interested in the symbolism or any of that. They're interested in what happens next.
Nice.
And that's the thing. You want your readers, stroke viewers, to be so invested in a character or a small cast that they want to know what happens next to them. You know, they're invested in. And I think, you know, I mean, citing Sex and the City is a really good example of where you're rooting for four very different people.
Exactly.
You know, and you know that they wouldn't all want the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think if you can create characters that in some way speak to somebody, and that starts with you as a writer, I think. You know, Judy really spoke to me, and, you know, people often say, oh, is Judy you, or are you, mm-hmm. you know, Judy's not me, but obviously I wrote her, so there's a lot of me in her, but I really care about her, and now I'm not writing any Judy. I think about her, and I drive past the places where, you know, that's a spoiler alert, but I drive past places where Judy in the book visits, and
I want
think
to know
about
what
her.
What happens? Does she get married? Does she, I mean.
I know, well, I think I dropped some clues throughout the book that Judy's going to be okay.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, it was brilliant the way you did it. I love it. Taking people on a story is such a gift.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and you take yourself on that journey as a writer as well, I think.
Yeah, you do. You go with it.
Yeah.
And what you were saying was really interesting, because Judy did something that was quite brave, and a lot of people can relate to that. When you were saying earlier about being rejected, I'm not ready to be rejected again. You know,
no.
Your career, to decide to leave your career and go and do something completely different.
You know, I think what Judy did, and I know she's a character, but she's real to me. I think what Judy did was quite brave, in that she gave something up that wasn't, she gave a life up that wasn't a bad life at all. It was, you know, what a lot of people would think is a really quite a nice life.
Her husband was nice. He was nice. He was nice to her.
He was, yes, and I've had a lot of feedback on that about how, you know, how she could leave such a nice guy. But I think sometimes in order to become who we want to be, we have to be around different people. Mm-hmm. And those people might come back into our lives.
Yeah.
But I think she did the ultimate thing of geographically moving. You know, she relocated and she left, you know, her family behind. And I think that's a strong... I think that's a strong political statement from a woman. I think women are encouraged to stay around and be the caretakers, and she had aging parents.
Exactly, and she had pressure from her brother.
Absolutely, who wasn't stepping up.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I was talking a lot about the expectations of women. I mean, I hope it reads like a breezy read, but I think I was making some serious points as well about the expectations of women, the pressures on women, and how it's much more difficult for a woman to say, stop this, I want to start again. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're not a young spring chicken, mm-hmm. you know, I think it's really hard to start a life where there are no guarantees, because we think all of our rejection is behind us, as we were talking about before. And actually, if you start a new career, I mean, I'm just trying to move into television writing now, and I know that will be a career where there's a lot of rejection, you know, and a lot of people saying, no, that's not for us, or no, that's not exactly right, can you change it? You go back with it, it's not right, can you change it? And we have to kind of, we have to brace ourselves for that. But do you know what? I think that's really living. When you can feel the wind going past your face as you're moving through a new life, I think that's really living. I think it's much easier to keep the status quo. Mm-hmm. And I think that is lovely. If you're enjoying the status quo, great. But I think if you have, I mean, I meditate, for example, so I do get quiet moments. And I think if you have any doubt that you're living the life that you want to live, I think you should put some serious thought into changing it. I'm not telling everybody. My husband always says to me, God, are you just telling women to leave their husbands? And that's not what I'm doing at all. But what I'm saying is, you know, as far as we know, we only get one life.
Yeah.
And so, you know, live it. Exactly, we said live it.
Oh.
You know, and that's not always an easy thing to do. And you don't have to do it in a huge way, but you can start to make small changes that make you feel as though you are moving in a slightly different direction.
I love that.
I'd encourage not only women, but women are mostly discouraged from doing it. I'd encourage everybody to do it, but particularly women.
Focus on it. I said in, I think it was chapter 7 or 8, Gold Diggers, to focus on maybe a couple of things that you want to do.
Yeah.
And just focus.
Yeah.
And part of me, I had that voice in my head saying, oh, you sound so arrogant here. But it was just true. It was my truth. I was speaking.
Yes.
This is what was going on in my head.
Yeah.
And it's how I was able to build Mummy Jojo into a kind of brand.
Yes.
And there's all these limiting beliefs telling you, no, don't do it. There'll be rejections. I mean, it sounds like you're doing amazing on this course. Like, I can see. I can't wait to watch your show. Cast me in it, a mojo character. No, but it takes guts. It's hard.
It
but
does.
It's
yeah.
Magical.
But you know, when you engage your guts, it feels great.
Do
you know what I mean? And even if you're just changing one small thing,
yeah, it could be anything.
Just you know, just change that one thing and see it through to the end, and then that will tell you, oh, I can make changes. So maybe the next change I'll make be slightly bigger, slightly more significant,
mm-hmm.
and then you do that, and then you change another thing, and then you change another thing, and before you know it, you're a screenwriter.
Oh, amazing! I'm so excited to see what the future holds. Award-winning author, next award-winning screenwriter. Oh, amazing! That's honestly going to have inspired so many people. So
oh God, I hope so.
I'm so chuffed.
And if any of your listeners are thinking of writing, just do it. Just do it. Just get a scrap piece of paper and start.
I'm sending you book number 2 for your feedback. Okay. Just need to get there first. But you're amazing. I love the way your mind works. You've got a marvelous mind. Awesome. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks.
Girl, what a girl. Not only is Angela Jackson an award-winning writer, she also happens to be an incredible singer. And Angela will say that singing is great for your physical and mental health, and I agree, which is why I do it so much here. Listen to this voice. Angela, sing us out. You are an absolute queen.
Say that you'll always be mine. This joy is something new. My arms are holding you. Never knew this thrill before. Whoever thought I'd be holding you close to me, whispering, it's you I adore, dearest one. If you should.
What a sexy voice. It's cut off, but I need to get her back to sing with the mics. I didn't realise how good she was. You are incredible. But yeah, however you sound, guys, keep singing, all right? Sing like no one's listening. Singing is so good. We should all sing. Thanks again for tuning in, guys. Have a great week. Mojo.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.